The following Dharma talk was given at Common Ground Meditation Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
So welcome back from a little bit of break time. I'm wondering if there are noticings from your small group conversations that you would like to bring to the big group. So can you say more about your questions about appropriation? Yeah. So I'm curious, were there people in your groups who had personal dilemmas around particular cultural practices and questions about, am I appropriating? Or were there people who had been accused of appropriating? Or I'm just curious if there was a personal kind of link to this question about appropriation. Oh no, no, you're being clear. I think it's helpful to just hear the context that your question comes from. So my understanding is you went to an event where there were a panel of people from different racial cultural backgrounds, and part of the concern that was a theme about what they were saying had to do with appropriation of their cultures and cultural practices. Am I kind of summarizing that? Yeah. So, well, I feel like this is a place to practice with our not knowing, and not knowing for sure, you know, what's the respectful thing to do. And here's where I think it gets tricky, is that part of my experience is people from particular cultural groups have different views. So not everybody from a certain group has the same view. And some people from that group might say, well, I'm, you know, happy to have you. Like part of my background is playing African drums. I'm happy to have you play African drums. Someone else might think that isn't an appropriate activity for me to do. One of the things I think is a way we can relate to this is to notice what it's like to like have this not knowing. Like there's not a definitive right answer that I can find somewhere about what should I do. But I know that the questioning for my own practice around African drumming helped me look more at, well, what am I doing and why am I doing it, and what do I know about the peoples and the places where these rhythms came from, and how am I in relationship to those? So it helped me be more conscious about my choices, helped me enter into conversation with other people about our practices. And So I think that's the path, is to use that kind of question as this opportunity to reflect more, to learn more, and then to, out of having more awareness inside yourself, coming to how do I respond to this? I think it's helpful to be in a situation like you describe, where as one of only a few white people, you got to really hear, you got to listen to the concerns of the people of color on the panel, and you know, maybe learn some new things about cultural appropriation from their perspective. So I think that's always a gift, and then we get to work with it and reflect on it. But I don't think there's a simple answer, like much of this stuff about race. Yes. Yeah, well, this is another great not knowing question. So you aren't going to know. And part of where our conversation is going to move is into talking about white fragility. So what happens if you, in your well-intentioned, wanting to learn way, ask something and someone is offended? And you could say this is one of those moments of disconnect that I talked about. I'm a little distracted by my paraphernalia here, trying to get it in place. So you have a disconnect, and then what? So can you hang in there and not just crumble or not just go away and say, I'm never going to try that again? What do you do in that moment? I think we will sometimes offend people, and this is because, like, whatever well-intentioned thing you might do, people are different, and this happens not just across racial lines. Like, it happens with the people in your family, the people you live with, and your friends. Like, this happens with people, that we have different interpretations, different ways of making meaning. And so sometimes, without intending to, the impact is that someone feels offended. And I think when we are talking about race, we have an opportunity to learn something from that person. So despite our good intentions, I think we need to set that aside and listen to this person about their perspective. And I, in general, think people are interested in sharing about themselves and their lives, particularly people who have been marginalized, who haven't had their voice heard and respected, often do want to share, but that doesn't mean everybody does. So there isn't a way to know for sure. And one of the handouts I gave you is called Silence Breakers. And this comes from Robin DiAngelo. And again, these are just possible phrases to use. They may or may not fit for you in a situation that you're thinking about, but they're meant to kind of seed your imagination about the kinds of ways that you could begin to ask a question. I'm trying to see if there's one here that might fit with what you were just asking. I guess number three, you know, I'm afraid I might offend you, and please let me know if I do. I'm just wondering if you'd be willing to share a little bit about your experience of what it's like to be the only woman of color working in an all-white organization. I can imagine that might be difficult at times, but could you tell me about it? Like, and then somebody might say, no, I don't want to tell you about it. That could happen. But these phrases are meant to give you a little bit of a beginning prompt to how you might ask a question. So that's what comes to mind in relation to your question. Other things from your small group discussions that you'd like to bring up? Yes. Yeah, I think not everybody has access to diverse community currently in their lives. Like, our living arrangements continue to be very segregated, and so it may take some effort on your part if you want a more diverse community. It might take intentional effort. And I think there are places you can go that make it more likely that you could begin to have conversation. And I'll just tell you about a thought I had recently. I was looking at my Seward Co-op newsletter, and I noticed at the new Friendship store over on 38th and I don't know what street, across from Sabathany Center, I noticed there's a couple of free events coming up that are either talking about a book. They're going to be talking about a book I noticed you had in your library called Citizen. I haven't read that book, but what's that? But it caught my attention in your library because I thought, oh, they're going to talk about that over at the Friendship store sometime in the next couple months. And I'm making up a story. I'm just imagining, but I'm guessing there will be some racial diversity in that group, in that conversation. So I thought to myself, because I do have a goal, because I'm often in the role of the teacher, I'm I'm wanting to put myself in roles where I'm not the teacher, or situations where I'm not the teacher, and just be in the community. And I was thinking, oh, maybe I would go to that book conversation. And so I'm on the lookout for those sorts of events, and like the event that you brought up about, you maybe didn't know ahead of time that you would be one of only a couple white people, but going to an event where it's a panel of people of color suggests that you're going to attract an audience that may be racially diverse. So I would be on the lookout for those kind of things that are in line with my interests and values as a way to expand my community and maybe be able to develop, you know, first of all, just starting about talking about the book or the movie or whatever is the focus, and that might lead you to connections that deepen. But I do think it's an important thing to be intentional about expanding our communities. Not the simplest thing to do. Other things that came up in your groups? Yes. Well, it's another great example of not knowing, right? And things change and people change. So people change how they identify themselves. And so even if you know what's true for somebody at one point, they might actually change how they identify. So I do think the more that a person pays attention to language, and in this case, language around race and people's identities and how to talk about certain racial topics, I think the more you do that, the more you have confidence that you know something, you have a little ground under your feet, and you also have confidence that if you get it wrong, it's not the end of the world, like that you know how to navigate that. And it doesn't have to be a huge, big deal of a disconnect. It can be, and I think the example you give of asking, please let me know what the language is, help me, you know what you like to be called. I think that you certainly can do, because you don't know, like people prefer different terms. So there's no way, there's no dictionary that will help you totally get this right. But do you notice this theme in the questions we're having, how we want to get the ground under our feet and we want to get it right and we don't want to offend, and it's messy, so we might get it wrong and we might offend and we might not have ground under our feet, and then what does our practice support us in doing is, you know, can we be kind to ourselves and other people? Can we relax? So we get to work with the messy not knowing. Yes?
I ended up at a conference.
Yeah, I appreciate your example about, you know, your discovery that even your question about what would be the right thing to do in a complicated situation in the community, you know, that focus on rightness is a reflection of whiteness. And I actually want to draw your attention to one of the rationales for white silence that links to that. And it's associated with the one, I don't have much to add. And one of the things that Robin DiAngelo said about this is that when we have an idea that our contribution maybe has less value than others, could this be rooted in the dominant culture's expectation that knowledge should be a form of correct information, that this is what counts, is to have this right, correct information? And sharing, you know, whatever's going on for us, whether right or wrong, whether it's clumsy or articulate, that's important. Like, that's important just in terms of us building community and trust and connection, and there's lots that we could share that isn't necessarily about right information. But I do think our socialization in, you know, dominant cultural schooling is really cognitively oriented and oriented towards knowing in a particular way. So I think it's a great, you know, great story for us to learn from when we have that coming up inside of us about wanting to do it right. And this is sort of associated with being good. I know for me, a lot of, you know, being good came through doing well at school. And so that's, you know, there's a association, I think, for many of us with knowing in a certain way, and that means I'm a good person. I do think there are other things like that. And if we look at the page of your handout that's about white fragility, it says challenges that trigger racial stress for white people, and you mentioned, you know, the racial stress that because we might be anxious, we want to do it right, we don't want to offend someone, we aren't very relaxed necessarily. We are, you know, really monitoring, controlling ourselves to try and get it right. And so Robin DiAngelo says that there are these challenges for us, things that trigger racial stress, and that what she calls white fragility is that if we have one of these challenges and then we withdraw, we defend, we cry, argue, minimize, ignore, or in other ways kind of push back to try and get some ground under our feet and feel more comfortable, this is what she calls white fragility. So maybe I'll just say I think there are things on this list that are other things that could be out of awareness for us as white people. So even just like suggesting that a white person's viewpoint comes from a racialized frame of reference, because most white people, I think, who haven't thought much about race, probably assume my view is neutral. Mm-hmm. And people of color actually have a biased point of view. They have a racial position, but I don't. I'm just neutral. I'm normal. And so this isn't a racialized viewpoint. Like, if I ask my students who are white, when did you first become aware that you're white, and how did that happen? And for some people, even in their 20s, that's a kind of a threatening question, because they don't think about themselves as white. They think about themselves as an individual. And race isn't about them. Race is about people of color. So even just to suggest that my view is not neutral but is racialized, shaped by my racial positioning, could be a challenge to someone and lead them to feel some stress or to, you know, push back and say race doesn't really matter. So maybe other things on this list would also fit for what you're asking. I think there was another hand. Yes.
Yeah, I just wanted to share an anecdote.
Yeah, so I appreciate your story that really vividly illustrates how you can't get it right necessarily, because people in the same category have different views. And I think one of the things that's important about your story is you didn't just shut down and go away when you got the first challenge. Mm-hmm. So, because that would have ended things. Yes. Like, if you would have just walked away. Mm-hmm. And so you hung in there enough to actually communicate some more and, you know, find out that these two people had different views. And now, I'm really curious, did they come and play?
No, they were like, we're getting the grill going.
So other things from your conversations you'd like to bring forward? So your dilemma is with your family, who sometimes says things that you would disagree with racially. You are silent, or you do speak up, or you do some of both.
I speak up with them, but they actually have asked me not to.
Okay. And they've asked you not to because of their discomfort. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I don't want to give you an answer because I don't know your family and your situation. So I really don't know what you should do. But I do think that we have these dilemmas in our relationships, and that we have choices to make, and it isn't in my mind, a choice about, am I trying to change somebody else? So I believe, you know, although change is the nature of things, there are some people who might not change their racial views, it isn't my job to try and convince them to see things differently. But what does concern me for myself is a couple things. One is, my own integrity matters. And so I know in my own family there are times when I haven't spoken and I have felt not in line with my own integrity. And so one of the practices I try and work with is this one that's called One True Thing. Can I say one true thing? So the one true thing might be, well, you know, I see this differently than you. And you might not say a bunch more about it, but you—that's your one true thing. So one true thing could be a small thing. I mean, it could even be, well, I don't even know for sure what I think about what you're saying, or I don't think I agree with that. But I'm going to think about it some more. Like, so you don't have to have it all figured out in order to say one true thing. So that's one thought that I have. And the other thought that I have is that I know from my own experience of trying these conversations in my family, I haven't always been very skillful. So, you know, I've said reactive things. I've not followed the good information I have about I statements. Mm-hmm. You know, whatever. I've done it in a messy way. And this thing about silence, I think, is a big topic because there are many identities that are silenced. So around race, as white people, we have privilege in the dominant culture. But other categories of identity, we might have, we might be positioned where we've been marginalized or haven't had a voice, or there's been power over us. So we have all of that complexity inside of us, and when it comes to issues of silence and speaking, it isn't all compartmentalized, like here's the white part of me and then here's the woman part of me, and it's like we have our patterns we've learned to survive in the world. And if there was devaluation that we experienced in our lives, silence is one way to cope with that. So we might have that as a strategy of just coping, getting along in our families and our communities. So when we go to challenge that, it isn't going to be all like perfect at first. And so the fact that you've been able to say whatever you've said, you know, already is, you know, it's a strength that you have going for you. When I've tried to do it, I've had to be kind to myself about how messily how reactively I've said certain things. But I'm also wanting to give myself credit because for me to, like, challenge my dad on some of what he said was, you know, that was a big step for me. So we're in different places, given our histories, about silence and speaking. And I think not to, you know, this isn't about, like, letting myself off the hook, But it is about bringing some compassion and patience to myself as I figure out what's a step for me. And for somebody else, it might be a really different step because they have a different life experience. They have different strengths and weaknesses. But I think the important thing, this is why I go back to the discipline. So around whiteness, we got a lot of room to do nothing. A lot of social support among other white people. And so how do you bring a little rigor into your practice around this? And I think it helps to get clear about what am I practicing? What do I want to try and do? And then see what happens when you either do that or you don't do that. Learn from that. Yeah, well, like, for example, one thing to do would be to say, I want to try to say one true thing. Another thing would be to say, I know I went to a race-related meeting some months ago, and I knew it was going to be all white women who were there. And, you know, I knew that if I didn't say something, because I'm one of those people who might say my personality is actually not to talk so much in groups. But I knew I wouldn't feel like kind of good about myself if I didn't say something. I went with the intention, I don't know what I'm going to say, but I'd like to express myself out loud at least once. Like that was my, you know, kind of intention, what I had named for myself. But I think what that is going to vary. Like for somebody else, it might be, I'm going to keep my mouth shut, and I'm not going to pipe up when it's silent. I'm going to let that space go, and you know, make room for someone else's voice. But to have something that's your focus. So because like race is too big, whiteness is too big. Like, what should I do about it? You know, I'll just notice. You know, and well, that's a good start, but it's a little bit loose. So other things you wanted to bring from your group conversations? Yeah, well, I agree with you that fear is really important, and that, like, so this would be a way to organize practice is to notice my fears. So, like, so if I were to tell a friend, oh, here's what I did with Black Lives Matter, how would they look at me, and then how would they treat me, and what am I afraid of? And even just if I didn't tell that friend, noticing the process I went through inside that led me not to tell them, that would also be useful information to reflect on, that how are our fears organizing our practices, how we show up in the world. And I think, you know, we don't think about ourselves as having white racial community, but there are people who have written about this, about how we get socialized to be white, and that our belonging, like belonging is really critical to survival, and our belonging is on the line if we stray too far from the socialization of our families. And if those families are white and those communities are white, that's a lot of conditioning about how to belong and how to be a good person in your family and your community. And I recently had a humbling experience, which there's a part of me that would prefer not to share this story, especially because it's recorded. But I offer it to you with the hopes that it will be useful to you in your own practices. And this is one of the things I think, like, if we have a mistake, what we call a mistake, or think of as something like, I wish I would have done that differently, which this story will illustrate, I think the thing to do is to learn from it and to use it to help ourselves and others be more skillful another time. So, you know, some of my stories are a long time ago, and I can say, well, I'm not that person anymore. But this story was from last month, so it's recent. And it happened one day in my neighborhood. I was walking home from the Y, and this is one of my practices I've taken up, is to try and be more friendly with clerks and, you know, check out people and random strangers, just to move out of my individualistically oriented socialization. So one of those beautiful spring days, and I was walking past this apartment building right around the corner from my house, and there was a guy out there, and I started making chit-chat about the sidewalk. And, he had been putting salt out. And then we started talking about the neighborhood and the new apartment building being built. And then he made a comment that was like about North Minneapolis and, you know, this South Minneapolis, so much better than North Minneapolis. And so right away, even with that, I could feel a little anxiety, like that's racially coded language. He's not being explicit, but that's some kind of a racial reference. And he actually went on to be very explicit and told me this story about living. He had lived in North Minneapolis, and this was a white man I was talking to. And he was telling me about this encounter he had with a couple of black men, and as he was telling me, he got more racially explicit and very derogatory. Jungle bunnies and N-word, and so it was very explicit. And as I was listening, I was aware, like, okay, I want to try and say something. I had that awareness. You know, probably right at the beginning when he did the thing about North Minneapolis, I had a little awareness like, oh, I hope he doesn't say something where I'm going to feel like I have to say something. So that came first. Then I'm starting to feel like I have to say something. And I'm also thinking, because of my practice, so I don't want to put him out of my heart. Like, I don't want to just write him off like he's the oblivious white person, I'm the good one. So I'm aware of that, and I'm trying to think about how to engage with the story. And I won't tell you all the details, but it was long and involved, and it involved him feeling targeted as a white person, and, which is a common actually among white people in the United States, to feel like white people are more discriminated against than people of color. So he's saying all this, and I did not say something to him. So I, despite having this conscious awareness and good intentions, despite my one true thing, everything I know, I didn't say something. So, you know, I don't feel good about this. That's why I'd rather not share. I'll get you in a minute. So I felt shame about it. I felt sick about it. And it comes up now. So because I feel shame about it, I feel like it's really important to talk about and not just hide out with my secret, because I know I'm not the only well-intentioned white person who, you know, has not been in line with her values. So I have used it. I've talked about it a fair amount publicly with my students. I went to school and, you know, talked about it because I'm wanting them to think about what could I have said, what might you say, what would you do? And I invite you to think about it like that too. And why didn't I? Like, part of the reflection is, so why didn't I? And, I think why questions we can't totally answer. So I, it's a story, a plausible storyline that I have for myself about why I didn't. And it relates to my history and my fear. And it relates to being a good white girl and my socialization about what that means in relationship to men. So I see that's deeply conditioned. But I feel really that it, you know, it's not okay. It's not okay that I didn't say something, that to not say something, this is part of silence, to not say something is to, it's kind of, to me, he had audacity to assume I would agree with him, but I didn't give him any reason to suspect that I didn't. So I didn't challenge, I didn't interrupt, and so he can now assume that there's white community sharing his view. And so this is the, you know, this is what's part of what's at stake when we don't speak up. And so anyway, I have thought a lot about that. And because he's in my neighborhood, I haven't run into him since. I've been on the lookout. I don't know his name or his apartment number, but I do know the apartment building. So when I walk past, I'm looking for him because I do have a thought about what I might say. And I don't feel like I have to just drop it. I do feel like I could potentially pick it up. I've gotten some help and support. And so when this relates to one of the silence breakers about power, when you have a perception of someone having more power than you, or you give your power to that person, you know, one of the things that you have the opportunity to do if you speak out is actually to heal those places in you that are linked to the ways that you have been silenced and not known how to have a voice. So I feel like I have many opportunities, one to do my own healing by finding my voice, but also to disrupt whiteness and to, I would like to be connected to him and to myself. Like part of what I learned in my growing up years was the way to stay connected to other people was to disconnect from myself. That was the way that you got love and approval. And so my aspiration is I want to stay connected to myself and to him. How do I do both of those? So I played out a very old pattern for me. So anyway, I offer that with hopes that it will be useful to you and allow you to face your fear and find ways to speak, but also to, what was the other thing I was going to say? Oh, to be kind to yourself, be patient with yourself, if you find yourself in a spot like me where you didn't live up to your aspirations. You had a comment. A question. Yeah. Well, I do think it's helpful afterward to do that thinking of what you could have said. Some situations it feels like it's too late and you miss the boat. But it's likely with a lot of things you're going to get another opportunity. And so your thinking about it helps you prepare. Because sometimes what happens is because we feel shame, we don't even want to look at it. We don't want to think about it. We go move away from it. So the looking at it, I think, is a helpful way to prepare for the next time. And I could share some of what I thought about, but I also might like to hear other people's thoughts about the kinds of things you think could be said in that moment. I think there's some maybe benefit in hearing other people's thoughts, not just mine. Is there anybody who has a thought of what you might suggest saying or what you might say?
In our small group, headbutting attitude.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was hoping somebody was going to bring that up because I overheard when Patrice was sharing, wow, really, you look at it that way? That's not how I look at it, or that's not my experience. So, yeah, I think that also helps address the not getting into, you know, making the other person the enemy, but being interested in how they came to that perspective. Was there another hand up? Yeah, he might have. I guess my own aspiration is to be a bit more direct. So I will feel more in line with my integrity and more clear about disrupting white racial solidarity if I speak more clearly and directly. But it is possible he read my silence as lack of agreement. I didn't join him. Yes.
I had an experience similar to this particular race.
Yeah, so I think that the opening it up, like, because so much of whiteness, because it's unmarked and unnamed, and because we have been trained to think of ourselves as individuals, to disrupt the silence, I think is quite important, and there are different ways to do it. But to open up the conversation, whether it's with questioning or with saying, you know, some comment, I think there's a lot of power in the disruption. Yes. Yeah, well, I'm impressed with what you've come up with about being able to do some naming, how you want to stay in a conversation, and yet you have some things that you're requesting that would help you. I think another variation of that, which is an idea someone shared with me to help me with my situation. They offered me the idea of saying to someone, you know, I'd like to keep talking to you. It's getting hard to listen when you, you know, talk like that or when you use that kind of phrase or language. So, you know, to stay connected with myself about this is hard for me to listen, even though I am wanting to know your story or hear from you. And I think this is where what I said earlier about not having to do it perfectly matters. Like, whatever somebody's able to say in the moment, I think if you haven't been able to say something in the past, then saying something is a good start. And then later you can refine it and polish it and get more skillful. But at first you're just finding a way to disrupt. So I appreciate you giving us another idea. Yes. Yeah, well, I appreciate you naming nonviolent communication, and I think as a practice, it's a very useful one for me, and to be able to empathically imagine what's going on for someone, even if they've said something that you find offensive, could be a soft startup, a soft way in to connect with them. And you potentially have then more room to discuss whatever's being said. It also, your story makes me think, because you're talking about a boss situation, so there are situations, and this goes back to the power dynamic, situations I've heard about where people say, I, you know, like a boss, this came from one of my students several months ago, she was saying, her boss was regularly making racist jokes. And this is a mental health organization. And you know, here she is. She's a, you know, lowly employee. She's at the bottom of the hierarchy and hesitant to say anything. And what I suggested to her was, how about, have you talked to any of your coworkers about this? I'm guessing other of your coworkers probably also don't like these jokes and find them offensive. And so this was big for her, because she was like me, a person afraid. And she talked to her coworkers, and they came together, and as a group, they talked to the boss. And then the boss was actually receptive. And so I think sometimes with our fears, if we come together with other people, then we have, especially in a situation of, like a work situation with a boss, we have more, more kind of strength in numbers. Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I appreciate your story and the complexity of it in terms of not just thinking about race in the U.S., but what that looks like as you start to filter it through cultural differences coming from other countries. And then the dynamic of being the boss. And so I think that's complicated. And another good example about the not knowing exactly what's the right thing, having had good intentions that had a very different outcome than what you had imagined. So I don't have an answer about that, but it does make me think about, on the handout, about the challenges that trigger racial stress. So it does name this as a challenge. It's the very last one. Challenge to the expectation that people of color will serve white people. That's the broader challenge. And an example of that Robin gives is people of color not being willing to tell their stories or answer questions about their racial experience. So, that having the outcome of creating a challenge or a stress for you in that particular situation. And it doesn't mean I think you were bad or wrong to try and have that conversation. But I think what Robin's naming here is that to have the experience you have would be likely to trigger some racial anxiety or stress for you, or maybe many of us as white people.
And it was interesting working with people who...
Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing. And your comment made me think of a poem that I appreciate in particular, the first couple lines of the poem. It's a poem called "For the White Person Who Wants to Be My Friend," written by Pat Parker. She was an African-American woman who's now died. But the first two lines of the poem are, first, forget that I'm black. Second, you must never forget that I'm black. And I think this is that both and thing. It's like, okay, so forget that I'm black. We're human beings. Here's our common ground. I want you to see me as a unique human being, sharing humanity with you. And I want you to never forget that I'm black, meaning there's a racialized hierarchy that has impacted me and you, and it's important to be aware of that. And so how to hold that both and. I think, to me, that's the complexity that we're working with when we're relating to each other. Yes.
I just wanted to say.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you naming that. There isn't one thing generally true about a whole group of people, that different experiences can happen, and. I too have benefited from people of color who have been very generous in helping me learn about their experiences and the racial realities they experience. I also have experience, I'm thinking about, so one of my friends who's been very generous with me, the last time I saw her, she had just been at an anti-racism training that was, you know, with many different people at it, but quite a few white people, and she said, and she's very generous, not just with me, but with a lot of people. She said, I am just worn out. I'm kind of tired of, you know, being there for white people. And what happened was at this training, when people, white people, when racial anxiety got triggered, came to her quite a bit on breaks and stuff, like seeking reassurance, but not even consciously doing that, like kind of unconsciously doing it. And she was depleted and worn out and a bit tired of that dynamic. So even the same person can be different at different moments in time. And I think what's important, because I've seen this dynamic before too, and I know the impulse in myself. I want reassurance that you still like me and that I haven't offended you. And, you know, whatever those impulses are in us that lead us to want reassurance, that's what we can work with in ourselves and our practices. Because, of course, as human beings, it's a valid need to want reassurance. But she might not be for her to carry the load of all that reassurance, that's too much. But my need is a valid need. So how do I work with that? And I think one of the ways we work with it is in white community, where we can help and support each other to tolerate the not knowing, to tolerate the anxiety or stress that we feel. So I appreciate you bringing that up. Yes?
One thing that's coming up for me a lot today, too, is just this cause.
Yeah, well, I appreciate you raising this question about what is the knowing. Like, so here we are with all this not knowing, but there are still some things to know. And part of what I gave you on the handouts, I feel like I tried to give you some little anchors, some knowing places. And even though there's a lot of not knowing related to them. So if we look at this list about these challenges, what Robin DiAngelo has done here, based on her work with a lot of experience with working with white people in the context of racially diverse groups and teaching on this topic. So she's named some of the things she's noticed. These are the kinds of things that trigger racial stress for white people. And she's pointing to the taboo about even talking about race. And so if people of color talk directly about race, it's not uncommon to hear white people say, see, they're making it the problem. If they wouldn't bring it up, it wouldn't even, you know, we wouldn't have this problem. I hear that fairly often. And so to notice, like, oh, that's a cultural pattern right now. Like, that's a knowing. Now, what to do about that in any given moment? Now, there's the not knowing. You know, like, so if I have a student say that, maybe I respond a certain way. If my family member says it, maybe I do it differently, and, you know, I don't know how I'm going to do it. And of course, there's the discrepancy between my aspiration and my what I can pull off in reality. But I think these patterns that are here on this list are pointing towards some things to know about whiteness and white practices in our culture. So challenge to racial solidarity. So, you know, if a white person doesn't provide agreement about your racial perspective, and we've been talking about that and the benefit of disrupting someone's expectation of that, challenge to white racial innocence. So this is that difference between intention and outcome. So despite my good intention, maybe I get feedback that someone experienced what I did as racist or they found it offensive. And what do I do then? How can I open to that information and not just say, well, but you know, I had good intentions, and so I'm off the hook. Challenge to individualism, I think I've talked about that. Challenge to meritocracy, this is another, you know, deeply ingrained belief that goes along with individualism and colorblindness, is that if we all just work hard, you know, then we'll get ahead. And this one, I think, so there's racial knowledge, a lot of different kinds of racial knowledge, knowledge about particular groups. Knowledge, too, though, about what does it mean to be in a culture where there are, you know, institutions shaped by a history of white supremacy, and how that plays out with transportation, and how that plays out with housing. And there's a whole bunch of knowledge there that most of it beyond what I know. I know just little bits, but really important realm to have knowledge, but it still doesn't give you an answer about, well, then what's the right thing to do? Like, people debate then, well, what should we do? Like, I was just reading this recent interview with R.T. Ryback, and he's heading up, you know, the former mayor of Minneapolis, heading up this organization trying to address the racial disparities in education. And he was talking about just breaking it down into these doable pieces. And I thought, well, that's encouraging to think about, to get a handle on. But there's still a lot of different choices about where to intervene on a problem like that, that's a big, pervasive problem. So even with the knowing, then there's the not knowing. Challenge to white authority. I think this is an interesting one related to Black Lives Matter and some of the comments I've been hearing about that. So, you know, if you have a person of color in a leadership position, and do you have confidence in their decisions, in their vision, in their authority? And what's that, what's that like? Because I think many of us didn't grow up in having experiences with people of color in positions of authority, and even now might not have that in organizations we work in. And so what's that like? And I know from stories from people of color in those positions, they feel a complicated experience many times of having power institutionally or organizationally, but having people question and doubt their capacity because of, you know, maybe it's because of being a person of color or being a woman or being queer or whatever category is not the dominant category. I think that's an interesting one for us today. So I guess I also just want to comment about challenge to white racial expectations and need entitlement to racial comfort. So what happens if we aren't comfortable? And this is what the white fragility is all about, is so if we're having these experiences of stress, what happens next? Can we hang in there? Can we not just go away, not just say, I'm done with that? And I think, you know, that's partly our practice can support us with this, but also our community. And I just want to acknowledge that I had had the intention to have you go back to your groups again. And I just want to acknowledge, with 10 minutes left, we aren't going to do that. And I made a choice a couple different times. I was going to interrupt the comments that were coming, but I made a choice that there was, you know, value in the comments we were hearing, and we seem to be doing a pretty good job with this size group of having that conversation. So anyway, we didn't get back to the smaller groups like I had imagined and intended. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I appreciate you reminding us that we have creative ways to try and engage with people, and that sometimes, you know, seeing that little film clip or hearing that story will have a bigger impact than what we're able to have in that moment with our words. Yeah. Yeah, I appreciate that example because I think it highlights that difference between intention and outcome, where the intention might be interest and curiosity, but there is a cultural pattern, and it's a microaggression when people over and over again get asked, "Where are you from?" as if you don't belong. And even, I just heard this story from a student of mine who identifies as white but has slightly darker color skin, and she told me how often she gets asked what she is, and people make comments about, "You look exotic," and so some of them are positive comments like, "Oh, I like your skin color," but she feels very othered by it. She feels excluded and like she doesn't belong. And so I appreciated your suggestions to, you know, like find your other topics about who you are together in this situation or their life as a entryway into getting to know someone. So I know you had a hand up, but we have about 2 minutes left. So the curious part of me wants to know what you're going to say, but I'm going to live with not knowing. And I would like to just end, though, with there was a quote here. If you go online and you look up Robin DiAngelo, you'll find different things she's written and also a long talk that she gave. But one of the things I found when I went and looked her up online, someone else had written about her, and that someone was Courtney E. Martin, who wrote a blog. And I'd like to just end with this quote and then sit together for just a minute before we close. So Courtney E. Martin said, "We have to show up as bold and genuine and imperfect. We have to be weary of our fragility. We have to be intolerant of our own forgetfulness. If it feels difficult, and it does to me, you're probably on the right track. Dismantling centuries of dehumanizing institutions and practices, both in the world and within ourselves, can't be a simple process. The good news is that transforming your fragility into courageous imperfection is the beginning of a lot more joy. It's the beginning of a lot more connection. It's the beginning of the end of racism." So let's just sit in silence for a moment. So I'd like to offer that whatever benefit we may have received from our time together this morning, that we use that and that it expand out into the world and help us create a world of kindness and compassion with all of our beloved community.
This talk, like all programs at Common Ground, is offered freely in the spirit of generosity. To learn more about Common Ground and its programs, or if you would like to donate, please visit our website, www.commongroundmeditation.org.